April 2013 marks a decade since the martyrdom of seven members of the Melanesian Brotherhood, an Anglican religious community founded in the early 20th century on the remote Solomon Islands. Known for their simple monastic lifestyle and commitment to justice and peace, the brothers were called on to serve as mediators during the ethnic conflict that raged across the islands during the 1990s. A fragile truce between the warring factions was signed in the year 2000, but one warlord continued to wage a terror campaign, prompting first one brother, then six others, to set out on a peace mission, a journey from which they never returned.
It was like a crucifixion. It was like, you know, suddenly everyone is looking to you, to your community, to be the hope of the nation, and then suddenly seven die.
Reverend Richard Carter worked for 15 years as chaplain to the Melanesian Brothers. He was charged with the task of telling the families about the brutal deaths of the seven men. During a recent visit to the Rome Basilica of St. Bartholomew on the Tiber Island, where the brothers' relics are displayed, he told me more about the history of the community and the impact the brothers' martyrdom had on the lives of people far beyond that remote Pacific region.
It's an indigenous community founded by a man called Ini Corporea at the beginning of the 20th century. He was a man who believed that the gospel should be taken to people and lived through the culture of the people. He was a Solomon Islander himself, and a great generosity of spirit founded this simple community with five other brothers, and it grew, and they quickly became known for their works of compassion, for their ability to live side by side with people and to teach by their words, but most of all by their actions, how to live the Christian gospel. And inspired many Melanesians themselves, so that many Melanesians treat the Brotherhood with great love and respect, because they see it as a community coming from them. And one of the great differences between other religious communities was in his vision that people shouldn't take life vows, that they should promise for a period of 5 years, and then if they wanted to renew their vows of poverty, chastity and obedience, but then be free later on in their lives to return to their community. And he said, a brother must be like yeast or like salt, and eventually he must go back to his own people and become a teacher or a leader or just someone living the gospel in their own native place. So that's really what I did.
How were you first attracted to this community?
Well, I went as a teacher and as a priest, and I was teaching at the theological college. But more and more I was drawn to their radical simplicity. It seemed that they were living the gospel in a very direct and very real way. And the community is a very powerful witness. And more they asked me to celebrate for them. Their chaplain became ill, and then I was asked to become their chaplain. And then I thought, after a while, I thought, well, if I'm celebrating communion, if I'm helping in their education and formation program, maybe I should have enough trust to become a brother myself, which I did. But it's not an easy vow. The brothers, you know, don't even have shoes. We sleep on mats. We eat twice a day. It's a very radically simple life, but a powerful lifestyle and a powerful witness.
You knew, therefore, these seven martyrs very well, didn't you?
I knew all of them. In fact, six of them I trained as brothers, and one of them was the leader of the community for many years, so I worked side by side with him as chaplain.
Can you describe perhaps the environment in which this conflict was taking place, the background to their martyrdom?
Well, like all conflicts begin, you know, you never really think they're going to happen. You think, oh, conflicts happen in other parts of the world, they're not going to happen to us. And then suddenly things start to go wrong. Prejudice leads to violence, and the violence quickly escalates. It began when one island group became thrown out of the schools. It began with children in a school, and then slowly we heard that this militant group was burning down villages, and then you thought, this can't be happening here. And then you heard that people had been killed, and you think, surely not in a country like this, not in a country which was known to be called the Happy Isles. And then you have to recognize that it is happening, and then when you recognize that it is happening, you have to decide what you're going to do. And it's not about sitting down and think, let's be brave. It's a question of actually responding to events as they escalate. And I remember the militants when they came running through our community for the first time and they were holding bush knives and slashing at the posts. And I suddenly realized this is real. You realize when people are running for their lives, it's no longer a game. It's no longer just a question of prejudice. It's where violence has actually begun to take over and it has a momentum and a power all of its own. And I think you can witness that all over the world.
Were you tempted at that time when you saw the violence with your own eyes? Were you tempted to leave, to flee?
I think the community I was in was the hope of the country. People looked towards the community because we didn't divide. Malaitans and Guadalcanal people continued to live side by side. And right from the beginning, we thought, if we divided, well, then what hope is there? We had to continue to live as a community. So it was rather than individual courage, it was a community in solidarity with one another, believing that we had to be peacemakers. There was no other way we could do. But of course, we were frightened.
And I imagine the seven men who died must have been very aware of the risks they were taking.
Yeah, Brother Francis, the last time I spoke to him, I knew he was on the warlord Harold Keke's death list, and I said to him, Francis, be incredibly careful. I said, you know, it's not, don't lose your life for this. And he said to me, I'd be frightened of dying if I was doing something wrong, but I'm not frightened of working for peace. And he was a very gentleman, but a very brave man. And so he all the brothers knew that the danger they were in. But I want to tell people that they weren't, you know, you think of saints or martyrs as people right up there in the sky, you know, and when I see their relics on the altar, I think, wow, you know, these people will be remembered for years and years, and yet they were human beings like you and me, with all the sort of humanity of you and me, the strengths and the weaknesses, but they were people who believed in peace. And I think, you know, they showed that love for one another and for the community they served and for the people of Solomon Islands.
What impact did their deaths have on the brotherhood, on the community there?
It was like a crucifixion. It was like, you know, suddenly everyone is looking to you, to your community, to be the hope of the nation. And then suddenly seven die. And to be honest, to begin with, it was like everyone doesn't know what to say. Everyone turns away. You live that grief and that struggle by yourself for a time. No one can understand what's happened. People start saying, oh, what went wrong? Why did this happen? And then slowly a new truth begins to emerge. You begin to see that what they stood for and what they did contains a greater truth, and that it's there if all of us have the courage we need to stand, and that the ways of violence are so incredibly destructive of all that is given and gifted by God, and that somehow these seven brothers have become for the nation to represent something different. And I remember the time of their funeral, and I was as chaplain, had to go and visit their parents and explain all these things that had happened, and I think, how the hell are we going to get through this? And then you suddenly realize that it's not you getting through it, but somehow you're being upheld by God, and that God's story is taking over. And I remember the day of the funeral when there's a 17-mile drive from Honiara right out to the community, and just saw people coming into the streets, and the whole place was filled with people. Yeah.
It was a difficult moment, obviously, for you then, and it still is, it remains with you today.
Yeah, but, you know, people, the whole nation, they declared a national day of peace, and you suddenly see that actually, you know, like in the words of Desmond Tutu, goodness is stronger than evil, and that light is stronger than darkness, and that although these seven brothers were just fallible humans like you and me, somehow by their love for their country and their love for God and their love for one another, they have come to represent something much greater and much stronger, and that something can draw other people into God's love.
My thanks there to Reverend Richard Carter, the former chaplain to the Melanesian Brotherhood. He currently works as a priest in the central London parish of St. Martin-in-the-Fields.